Spend our days feeling like we're the only one with problems while everyone else has their act together. But the sooner we realize that everyone struggles like we do, the sooner we can show grace to ourselves and others. This is the Amazon.com description that I just read for the book Low Anthropology, The Unlikely Key to Having a Gracious View of Others by David Zoll. The author of this book, which Publishers Weekly calls a lighthearted yet high-minded exploration of failure's ability to serve as a gateway to grace. Readers will find this a balm, unquote. David, we're happy to announce, is the guest on this podcast episode, and so I know our listeners are going to be very excited to hear this conversation. Dave's going to get into why he wrote this book. He's going to talk a little bit about the book without, of course, spoiling it too much, as well as talking about his work in ministry with Mockingbird. We've had guests from Mockingbird Ministries on this podcast before. It's a ministry that Doth Protest very much supports. We're going to hear more about that, as well as with Dave's work in ministry at his home Parish Church of Christ Episcopal in Charlottesville, North Carolina. So in this episode, you will have heard us briefly refer to something that's happened in my life, and I'm Reverend Andrew, by the way. I know we have different hosts on the show, me, Charlie, James, and Stephen, but and our longtime listeners can usually recognize, you know, whose voice is whose, but this is Andrew, to clarify. And I have recently accepted a call to serve as rector of St. Michael and All Angels Episcopal Church in Lake Charles, Louisiana, something I'm very excited about, upon meeting the vestry and the people and having conversation with them and exploring this, that this is indeed God's calling for me to go there. Rachel and I will be moving in the next few months, and so we are very excited about it, but also, of course, with feelings of grief and sadness for leaving a wonderful community behind, the family and kids that I've served and taught for the past couple of years at Ascension Episcopal School, which has just been wonderful. And so Rachel and I will indeed miss this community. And so this, like any change and transition, comes with all its mixed feelings. But we are very excited about what lies ahead and the opportunities. And so enough of me talking here. We will go ahead and get on with the episode, and very excited to have Dave on. God bless. Hi, and thanks for tuning in to Doth Protest Too Much, Keeping the Reformation Alive. I'm Andrew. We got Stephen and James with me as well today. And also we have guest author of the new hot-selling book, Low Anthropology, Dave Zoll. So welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Drew. Thank you.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on.
Hot selling. I'll take it.
Is it best selling? I don't know what even like constitutes best selling, because I feel like there's different lists and stuff, you know.
Well, Amazon does this very shrewd thing where they just create tiny categories where everyone can have. It's like the participation trophy of book releases. So like everyone becomes like the number one bestseller in a minute. So I think today I'm still the number one bestseller in Christian theological anthropology. So
Christian theological.
I got that going for me. Put that on my gravestone. Yeah.
There you go. Christian theological anthropology. And I was about to ask, what are the categories? Are there any other subgenres you're put into?
I mean, the metadata is like, you only have so much control over it. I'm pretty sure our publisher didn't choose those categories, but it's also sure. In maybe spiritual formation or the seculosity. My previous book was always in Christian social issues. It was always okay. Going up against the guys from Duck Dynasty.
And there you go. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you fared pretty well against them.
Oh my gosh, they were toast. Forget it.
Yeah. For our listeners, I gave a little brief intro in the beginning, but Dave Zoll is the founder and editor of Mockingbird Ministries and the editor-in-chief for their website. He's based in Charlottesville and has served since 2010 as the college and adult education minister and lay preacher at Christ Episcopal Church in Charlottesville. He's the author of numerous books, including A Mess of Health, Crucified Soul of Rock and Roll, Seculosity, How Career, Parenting, Technology, Food, Politics, and Romance Became Our New Religion, and What to Do About It, Long Gospel of Theology for Sinners and Saints, and his latest book, which we'll be discussing today, Low Anthropology, The Unlikely Key to a Gracious View of Others, published this year through, I always mispronounce this, is it Brazos?
I've always heard Brazos, but Brazos. I don't know.
Yeah, Dave Nelson, who used to be an editor, he's been on the podcast, but now he's with Baylor. But yeah, Brazos, they have good Bible commentaries and stuff, from what I've read. So Dave, thank you for being here. I'm excited to dig into some of this book, what your reasoning behind kind of writing it. I'm really curious about like your reasoning behind the impetus of why you wrote the book. There seems to be kind of an undergirding message to really all you do. And that message, which I won't spoil what the message is, I want to hear from you, though I think this podcast very much shares that message. But that message is central to the mission of Mockingbird. We've discussed Mockingbird here and there on Doth Protest. We've had a couple guests in the past who've written for them. But we have the founder on today, so I'm curious, and I think our listeners are too. We'll start with Mockingbird. What led you, and I mean really, what was going on externally, internally, as much as you want to share your journey that gave rise to this ministry? And what is this ministry about?
Well, there's a lot, like anything that you start or that gets started, there's a lot of different things that going into it, some of which are sort of like the public story, some's like the private story. I'm transparent about it. It's a mix of a bunch of different things. So first of all, I had been a youth minister for 5 years in boarding schools and was sort of ready to move on to that, partially because I was engaged and wanted to continue doing ministry. But at that point, my tradition, which I was brought up in the Episcopal Church, that my older brother, I think, was in seminary at that point. My father was part of a seminary. He was running a seminary. And just it was the height of the just meltdown and fighting in the Episcopal Church that I is honestly just not nearly as present, partly because like a lot of people just peaced out, but it was 2005, 2006 was a miserable time. So I knew people on all sides of the various questions. And, mostly it was about sexuality, but there's also about the Bible and property was involved and history and liturgy and all these things. Everyone was miserable. Everyone hated it. It was just like, I was like, why would I want to do this with my life? The timing just didn't work out. And so I thought, well, is there anything else we could do? I had a bunch of friends, some of whom were on the ordination track or ordained. And we had the hubristic notion that Christianity in America was far too legalistic and needed some reformation, needed some, these are mostly young men who'd been gripped by the grace of God. And I would say for the sake of this podcast, had been gripped by Reformation distinctives, the distinction between the law and the gospel, the bondage of the will, justification by faith, by grace alone through faith alone. That's was a major, major thing. And we wanted to start an organization that could freely and without getting bogged down in ecclesiastical, waters or quicksand, could just sort of be nimble and just see what we could do in terms of trumpeting that voice or amplifying it. I also wanted to continue doing ministry in person. And so thought, what it would be like to start an organization that sort of was really founded on along these lines. And so we had some, I had some resources because of working as a youth minister and having to raise my own support, and I had friends, and we had a little small little board, and we had some opportunity in New York City where my wife to be was living. And so we just decided to try a bunch of things and see what stuck. And if you look back, not only was it a difficult time in the Anglican Episcopal world, it was sort of an exciting time on the internet, and people were blogging, and it was the explosion of that. My wife was part of a print magazine that was dying, like all print magazines, because new media was just exploding. And so part of what we had started with Mockingbirds, we did start a blog, you know, on Blogspot. And
back in the day, yeah.
Back in the day, this is 15 years ago, and just saw what stuck, you know, did some publications, some conferences. And I think the seed of Mockingbird was really started out of a group of people, mostly Episcopalians, who were looking to do ministry outside church walls that was sort of centered on the grace of God, and for, where they didn't have to be bogged down by culture wars. And it had some agency, I guess, or lack of authority. I don't even, however you want to charitably or uncharitably look at it. So that's how it started. And, you know, what it became is something entirely different. And the Mockingbird, the name, by the way, it proceeds from, like, a mockingbird is repeats the song it's heard. So there's a foundational understanding in Mockingbird that the gospel is not something we ever graduate from. I mean, the forgiveness of sins, you know, the absolution of the sinner, this is not something we ever exhaust. And so, like a mockingbird, we repeat the song we've heard over and over again, hopefully not in irritating ways. But that's the basic history. There's lots more I could go into, but that's how it started.
Well, that experiment you and a few other like-minded people came to has developed and evolved into something that I think is a blessing to many people like myself. Thank you. And it's interesting how you talked about culture, and I know Mockingbird has kind of a pop culture commentary component to it. And a little later, maybe we have time, we can get into that. I know, you know, this is all now back in the day. It's like that late 2000s, early 2010s kind of period. And it's funny because when you say kind of that, what culminated into you being in a place, starting Mockingbird and all that, followed years of strife and infighting in the Episcopal Church. And we're, you know, it's interesting because I'm seeing kind of that gap that I experienced. I mean, you know, I'm not bringing up age and stuff, but we got the Gen Xer here, a few years older than me and where I am at in my life ministry. Mm-hmm. During that kind of period where there was a lot of the infighting, I was kind of out of the church. I mean, I was in my late teens, when the infighting in the Episcopal Church over sexuality was going on. This is like mid to late 2010s, and you know, all that's going on, and I was pretty much absent from it. I came back to the church in my early to mid 20s, and I've shared deeper details, personal details about that in other episodes. But by the time I was back, I found very much a hegemonic flavor to a lot of, like, you know, church events and conversations and discussions and panels that part of me, and it's weird because you'd probably be like, oh gosh, I'd never want to revisit those days. But part of me would be like, you know, to have some diversity of thought or opinion would be nice to have. Like, oh my gosh, like I missed all those infighting. Not that fighting's good, not that, you know, because I've heard ugly stories, just antagonistic stories of those days on all sides of just people and it just mean-spiritedly at each other's throats over those issues. Part that's understandable is because those issues really run deep. But you know, part of me is like, gosh, I missed the big debate, and now everyone's like not wanting to have a debate about anything because it's all, you know, just keep the peace. We don't want to fight anymore. So, which I understand that too. So it's just interesting seeing the kind. I don't know where I was going. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I just would say that I'm personally not a fighter. Like, I don't, I find I'm much more drawn to unifying people. And yet, you know, I find all the self-righteousness that is involved on all sides of having to stake a bunch of stakes in the ground is really unavoidable, and I find it to be lamentable. And naively or not, we hope that Mockingbird could sort of be somewhere where we just get on with the ministry or at least talking about the gospel. Mm-hmm. And you know, that sounds condescending, because it's like for people who care deeply about things that divide the church, like they think they're caring deeply about the gospel. So I don't want to talk down, but I certainly think in myself, I'm not constitutionally set up for fighting. And I wanted to carve out a space where we could just see if it could work, where we could just sort of talk about grace and get back to the main things. And you're right. I was talking to a bunch of PCUSA pastors recently, and they were saying, you know, the truth is our publications, once all the conservatives left, the publications got, they all just sort of became, and these are all sort of, you know, people who remained in that church. They said they all got very one-sided and one note. And when the conservatives left, they took a lot of the energy and certainly the diversity with them, ironically enough. And they also took a lot of the prayer. That's what they said. And so they sort of had this wistfulness, like they don't want to revisit that. And I'm sure, you know, there's all sorts of, I watched everyone on both sides of these things misbehave in every conceivable way. Mm-hmm. And I just, it was more just a human thing for me. It's like, I just watched it. It's like, why do I want to, I don't want to do this. Like if I can serve God in other ways, I'll do that.
Yeah. And I see that in Mockingbird. I've gotten the 9 of the Enneagram test. I used to not like the Enneagram. I'm kind of warming up a little more to the idea that it might be good to, you know, to see where your core is of your orientation. But, you know, I've gotten that on the 2 of the 3 times I've taken Enneagram. So that's kind of part of my skepticism of it. I've gotten the 9, which is the peacemaker, the unifier. That's part of why I like having, you know, let's get all the sides involved and make peace. That's kind of it. But Mockingbird is unique in that it doesn't kind of add to the flames of the culture. That it does have a central message that is not, that kind of transcends that culture war and that infighting. And that's the message of grace. And do you want to speak more to that?
Yeah, it's my fondest, my proudest thing is that Mockingbird is a, you know, in some ways we're a very small tent, in some ways we're a very big tent. We've got people who feel very differently about any number of political and social issues. I mean, trust me, it really runs the gamut. And we've lost folks for that reason, just the discomfort of being with someone while we are a small tent in the sense that we're all kind of people who believe in justification by faith, and that's not a very some kind of substitutionary atonement, and that's not sexy or fashionable in mainline churches. And so there's a theological eccentricity to us, which I think allows us to be slightly broad, but it's still an eccentricity. The message of that Mockingbird is interested in, I'm interested in myself, I'm interested in translating the sort of core truths of the Bible and of the Christian theology into sort of everyday experience and everyday life. And those core truths that I'm speaking about is that human beings are profoundly in need of help and in pain, sometimes much of their own making, and that we are need God. Excuse me. And that secondly, that God is not only real, but God is gracious, and his fundamental revelation is in Jesus Christ, which is, you know, the shed blood of Christ and him crucified. So it's like those, and how that works out in the life of a believer is usually through some experience of redemption through the forgiveness of sins. Mm-hmm. And so those things I think people say, oh, that's that certainly sounds like a traditional view, but I've got plenty of people who are, theological or social progressives who sign to every aspect of that. And I have people who are, you know, social conservatives who agree with every aspect of that. And so to those who say, you know, you cannot coexist or this doesn't transcend, you're just like, well, I mean, I sort of feel like Mockingbird is some kind of proof that it can, and yeah. that people are drawn to the existential dimension of what we're talking about, that takes suffering and sin very seriously, but also takes the cross unbelievably seriously as well, and ourselves not seriously almost at all.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of focus. I mean, if you go to a football game, it's not divided between liberals and conservatives.
Yeah.
People are in jerseys and they're screaming, they're passionate, and they're all on the same team because they're focused on this one aspect of life and not all of the other ones. And the ability and the focus you guys have on, we're gonna make the gospel the number one thing. That's what we're gonna talk about. That's what we're gonna write about. That allows, I think, as part of what allows you to kind of sidestep so much of this the culture stuff that's divided so many people.
Mm-hmm. But you also, Mockingbird also has the propensity for pissing off both sides too, because the gospel is scandalous. Like the reality that we are saved by grace alone, through faith alone, by the work of Christ alone, is scandalous. Like that's actually something that unifies many conservatives and progressives against something like Mockingbird, because they'll misquote Bonhoeffer and say that you're preaching cheap grace, or they'll say you're just being, you know, Casper Milquetoast about the issues that are at hand, the issues of the day.
Yeah.
And I think that means that you're doing it right, because you're not centralizing the adiaphora. Or I don't want to demean the arguments, because I have my own positions on these too, but rather you're centralizing the thing that is central, which is the saving work of Christ.
Well, thank you. I think salvation is not a dirty word, and it's actually a very, very hopeful word.
Yeah.
And there's some people that, you know, you think the possibility of forgiveness is like insulting somehow, but I would say that's true, James. I don't know how helpful it is to talk at the larger Mockingbird Project without sounding vastly self-important, because it's a small thing, and it's, you know, it's eight people, you know, it's 15 years. We've put a lot of work in, but it's not the biggest deal in the world. But I would say that we get equal, maybe not equal. I say our harshest critics always come from the right. And our, but we also get a lot of critics from the left as well. Mm-hmm. So it's, and that's changed over the years sometimes, but I would say by and large, you can be so outflanked on either side. And I've never felt, it's so funny whenever I get a super conservative telling me I'm a coward, or that we're not talking about such and such and such, you'd be like, well, let me talk to these progressive critics of mine, because they seem to think the very opposite's true. And like, I guess if you actually knew what I was dealing with, and the same with the people on the left, you'd be like, well, you guys sound just conservative. And you're like, well, let me tell you what the conservatives actually think of us. They don't like us at all. Like you sort of feel like you're writing yourself out of an audience, you know, but I find that there's an exhaust, what do they call it? Like the exhausted majority or the exhausted middle. And maybe that's where we can live. Although our understanding of the grace of God is not moderate. It's very radical. So, the landscape's always shifting too, you know, like what was the way that these things, the way that it looked 15 years ago, it looks differently now. And some would say the internet like accelerates church struggles and whatnot. I ultimately find most of it is like, I mean, maybe rearranging chairs on the Titanic is too strong, but it's a lot of like, we're trying to address the world. And if I'm getting crossfire from the church, it becomes less and less important to me every year, because it's like, I'll just say the crossfire matters less and less to me every year as I see like the world itself suffering so much and in need of the grace of God and any kind of hope or meaning, that the inter-Christian battles feel more and more like a distraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was fine. I like how you talk about moderateness too. I mean, political centrism or social centrism can be its own idol and its own kind of extreme in a way too. So mm-hmm. I like how you know, the emphases of Mockingbird, and I'm going to use this as a segue to get to lower anthropology. The emphases in Mockingbird are on justification by faith, which is the theological way of saying that God saves us through the blood of his son, Jesus Christ, and that salvation comes by no effort of our own at all, because there's nothing we can do to save us. And despite whatever you've done, whoever you are, Jesus loves you and he accepts you. And that part may offend some, but it is definitely, I think, would be appealing to the progressive side of mainline Protestant Christianity, because it's about acceptance, right? And it's mm-hmm. about love. And that acceptance and that love is real. And then on the other end, your other emphasis is on the, I forget how you put it, but our need for a savior, basically, that we are fallen people and that we are faced with, we have limitations, and also that we come with inherent frailties, which I think could maybe appeal to certain people on the right who get, who look at very optimistic projects, especially in like political realms, and say, wait, hold on. So, yeah, I think like there's, it can equally, it transcends the language of our culture wars and our political battles, the message of the gospel. And I think there's something from people on all those different leanings and dispositions to find that in a way may affirm them, but it's also going to offend people on all sides as well. And that's why the gospel cannot be domesticated into a cultural or political project. Which brings us on that note of the fallenness of humanity to low anthropology, which is the title of the book. I have heard, and I'll let you speak to the origin of this term, but I heard it was originated by someone in the family. But what you tell, I guess you could tell us the history of where the word comes, the term comes from, but also define it for us. What is low, this is the title of your book, Low Anthropology. What does low anthropology mean?
Well, low anthropology is, so I'm using anthropology in the theological or philosophical sense. It refers to your operating view of human nature. So what does it mean? You mean when you say I'm only human, or what are the presuppositions you have about what human beings are good at and not good at, or capable of, incapable of, et cetera, et cetera. So a low anthropology, which the phrase was coined by my father. I didn't know that until I started writing the book. And I asked him, like, where did you know, I've heard, you know, people talk about an Augustinian anthropology or a Pauline anthropology or, you know, a Marxist anthropology, but like, where did you hear use the phrase low anthropology? Where did you get that from, Dad? And he said, he like paused and he said, well, son, you know, come to think of it, I think I actually came up with that. And I thought to myself, that sounds right. So a low anthropology is what is my euphemism for a biblical or a Christian or Augustinian anthropology view of human nature. And it is not a euphemism for original sin. It includes that. But it is not a euphemism for people are bad, though it sort of doesn't shy away from that. Low anthropology, I talk about it as having to do with three pillars. First of all, that we are limited. We are all have limitations. That's another translation of the sort of creatureliness, that there's a God and we are not him. We're not he. And that no one can know it all, no one can do it all, no one can be it all. Our time, even itself, biology, these things place hard limits on us. We all need to sleep 8 hours, you know, or at least eventually, even if you're Keith Richards. And so that there's no moral component to that. There's no judgment to it. It's just simply the truth of our life and these bodies of ours. The second pillar is doubleness, which is my way of talking about the bondage of the will, which the sort of Lutheran Protestant understanding of the will being something that's bound, that we're not free to, we might be free to choose between white socks and blue socks, or to eat, you know, Mexican food or cheeseburger for lunch, but we're not free to love God for the right reasons. And we're not free, the higher the emotional import gets on any given subject, the less actually freedom you experience when it comes to those things. So this is the Romans 7 understanding of life, that everyone's a jumble of competing motivations. And we pretend to be primarily emotional creatures. The great Cranmerian anthropology is one I borrow from Astley Null, that what the heart desires, the will chooses, and then the mind justifies. Like, that's
so. You're saying we are not free on our, like, we, there's no ability for us in our quote free will. Mm-hmm. To do actually true good, like good in the eyes of God. Like, we don't have that power within ourselves to will those things.
Not to will them. I mean, to do good in the eyes of God is to do the right thing for the right reason, which is out of love. And human beings do those things. It happens, but it never happens by a conscious choice of sort of in order to do. Because once you're doing something in order to do something like that, you're no longer doing it out of love. You're doing it out of obligation. And I'm convinced that the ethical engine of the Christian faith is gratitude and repentance and all these historical truths. But yes, I would say that people are bound up, and you just translate into, like, everyone's tied in all sorts of knots. No one really understands what they're doing. And if you expect people to be rational creatures making reasonable decisions all the time, you're going to come to hate them because no one acts that way. No one just, this is the right thing to do. Okay, well, then I'll do it. You know, there was a cartoon I posted today on Mockingbird of two koala bears talking to each other. And one says to the other, he says, I've decided I'm going to start making my life better instead of worse. And the other koala bear says, well, why were you making it worse? And then the other koala bear just like says, I don't know.
Right. Like,
yeah. The third pillar of low anthropology is self-centeredness and sin. So that there's a dark side to human nature that is just, that again is written into the code somehow. The physics of it or the origin of it is of less interest to me than the sort of empirical fact of it. And so this is our low anthropology, that we are created in the image of God, which is what everyone always wants to lead with, but that we have limitations and our willpower is also captive, and especially when it comes to the big things, and that we all have a shadow self, you know, that there's my kids just want to sometimes inflict pain on one another, and I just, it's not necessarily socialized. So that's what a low anthropology is. It's a picture of people in need of help from one another, but ultimately from God. Not just help, they need intervention and new life, resurrection. So the book is an attempt to catalog the ways in which such an understanding, which sounds insulting or negative, actually bears all sorts of beautiful fruit in the here and now. And ultimately is a precursor to the great force for good in the world, which is God. And so faith is what comes from a low anthropology, because if, you know, it's only the sick who need a doctor.
It brought up to me, and that's Jesus' sayings. It's the sick that need a doctor. But it brought up to me, like, there's common objections I hear when people object against original sin, or they object to the idea that humanity left to their own devices is a helpless species. What they object to it is, like, how could you, like, think of us so low and humans so low? And, like, do you watch the news? Do you turn on the news? What kind of news do you get? Granted, the media likes to focus on the negative, but the fact that the negative that is there, even if it's the minority of human affairs going on, is so depraved and so bad, right? Isn't that literally a sign in the real world going on in front of you that humans are imperfect? And then the other objection I get, when, again, this kind of gets into the Catholic versus Protestant debate, but, you know, that the question of, you know, good works contributing to our salvation, are good works contributing to our salvation? Like, okay, so you're just saying you can get into heaven without good work. So like, you know, Jesus saves you and you can just like do whatever you want with that and not have to worry about doing good things. Well, part of me is like, well, someone who's really been genuinely saved and hears the gospel is compelled mm-hmm. to do good things. But that's besides the main point is, if you have to do good things and good works in order to enter heaven, then you're doing those, like you said, you're doing those good things, you're doing those good deeds and those loving deeds for yourself in order to save yourself from the fires of hell. So it's not about the person you're actually helping, it's about you. You know?
Yeah, rather than your neighbor or God.
Right.
I'm with you. I think, like, again, it's the difference between walking through life disappointed and embittered that people act the way they do and that you act the way you do, if you're being totally honest, and or being going through life being in awe of how much great and beautiful and good things happen in spite of the fact that I am what I am and what people have done to me and what I watch them do to one another. Like, it's a completely different radical I think unburdening of expectation that also puts the onus on God to be good and to God to hold to the promises. And rather than you and I needing to summon up some free will muscles that are long since atrophied. So it's, we live in a culture of high anthropology that views people as this, like this or like that, those kind of people, and that just blames everyone for not living up to our understanding of what human beings are capable of. And you know, it's like, we always, when we fall in love, we tend to fall in love and we believe that the other person is better than we are, you know, we get really disappointed when we find out they're just as human as we are. But that's also where real love begins. Like, that's where no one feels loved when it's simply just like they're feeling worshipped. You know, how many girls, dude, I remember who like ran screaming for the hills because they could sense that I was trying to worship them or trying to, I like thought too highly of them, putting them on a pedestal when they just actually wanted to be loved. And to be loved is to be known, and to be known is to be known in your weakness, not in your strength or beauty. And it doesn't like preclude those things. But this is simply the way that I think it's set up. So love is mixed up inextricably with weakness, and the love of God, it makes no sense outside of like, oh, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. I mean, that's the whole loaf right there. It's not Jesus died for those who proved themselves worthy, or he died for those who won respect of their peers. It was much more what's attractive and earth shattering, in fact, about this message of the gospel is that God sees us the way that the greatest love story ever told. It's true. It's like you see us in full view of our inadequacy and you don't turn your face away. That is grace. That is the change agent in the whole world. And it is ultimately the power of God in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's just this whole theology or low anthropology is, I think, so meaningful for the life of the church and for the life of the world. And one of the ways that I will sometimes describe it to people who, and I mean, I'm not a perfect low anthropologist, because I don't think one exists either, because I yeah, naturally,
that's the whole point right here. Yeah.
Right. I naturally tend towards doubleness and self-righteousness and you know, waving my fist at my limitations. But one of the things that I try and instill in my people when I'm preaching is that when we hear the hammer of the law, when you know, the rich young fool comes to Jesus and says, "What must I do to gain eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Simple, keep the commandments." And then the guy comes back and says, "Done all that, no problem. What else?" Of course, I think, man, that dude is super self-righteous. And then I think, I also have done that myself. When the guy's response, if he had a low anthropology, and if we had a low anthropology, would actually be, "Wretched man that I am, who will save me from this body of death?" And I think that one of the things that your book does is it tries to instill in layman's terms that message that please recognize that we all fall prey to sin, mm-hmm. that we are all broken and in need of God's saving grace, that it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, you still ultimately, these are my words, not your words, you still ultimately suck just as bad as I do. And we have a savior in common who gives us salvation as a gift by grace through faith. And that is a remarkably honest take in a world that is so curated.
Well, thank you, James. And more at least that's, I agree with what you're saying. I think the curation is the great, is such a wonderful word for attempt. You know, is like, it's just a comma, it's a euphemism, a contemporary euphemism for sort of looking to justify yourself by works of the law. You know, I'm curating what you see of me so that you only see the good, the lovable, or the appropriately vulnerable, you know, the like sort of casually fractured rather than the seriously problematic about me,
right?
The lovable, you know, it's that kind of curation doesn't really do much for people. It leaves them lonelier. So, you know, guys, I haven't really mentioned on so far, but the book was born out of, yes, a desire to translate what I would think is a Christian anthropology in the way that I understand it to be of great comfort and good news and a precursor to faith in all the important ways. But I also saw the havoc that a high anthropology wreaks. And like you, James, I don't hold this with the part of being a low anthropologist is that you don't hold it with any consistency. Like you're no less prone to it than other people, or to being hypocrite. But I saw an immense amount of burnout. I saw it among clergy. I saw it among people in churches. I saw it in middle schoolers, and I saw it in, you know, young mothers and people in their 60s. People are living a life that demands too much of them, more than they're capable of. There's no sense of our actual limitations, and it's driving people crazy. And the other thing was that everyone was so lonely. We just saw this, you know, go through the roof during the pandemic. But loneliness, especially among men, but among all people, I mean, male communities are probably the ones in which, you know, there's a special intolerance of weakness, at least on the front end. But the social media informed world that, again, Silicon Valley didn't create this, but it certainly leverages it, where we have to constantly parade our own virtue or our own shininess or our beauty or whatever have you, enviability, like that creates loneliness because you never are telling the truth about anything. And no one feels loved when their profile gets liked. They feel a momentary boost of dopamine, perhaps, but because you know that that's not really you, that's, you know, it's a fiction. So high anthropology in that respect, which views people as basically pretty great and or as really defined by their achievements and their strengths, and of the only limits are the ones you put on yourself, you know, that the fallout of that is not like neutral, it's despair, you know, it's suicide, it's abject misery. So I think a low anthropology, while it sounds a little bit bracing on the front end, is actually the doorway to love and unity and compassion and communities that function on a low anthropology tend to be totally transformative in the most positive sense. And I'm talking about AA here, but I'm also talking about a really good church. But they are not places where everyone just whips each other, you know, with the cords of recrimination, you know, and shame.
A struggle session. Well, that's what they called it in Maoist China, but
sure. Well, I mean, I can imagine the phrase "I thought I was the only one," right, would be one that pops up in people that come into these low anthropology communities, because there is that. I was going to ask you, like, if people are so bad, then explain my Instagram feed, man. Like, yeah. Explain why I look so good. I guess so. Going through these three legs of the stool, I can't see much pushback at all on the fact that we're limited. Maybe the ways in which we're limited, there could be some argument there, but it's pretty straightforward. The fact that we're selfish, I mean, I think I think everyone can accept and understand that. And even the idea of doubleness, we've all experienced that. But my question is, or one of my questions is, why do we have to say as Christians that the good that we do isn't good? Why can we not just say that it's not good enough? Right? Like, why do we have to say that it's not actually good?
Why do we have to say that the good we do isn't good? Well, as a Christian, I believe that once you start to categorize things that you're doing as good, you start to trust in yourself. And the purpose of the Christian life is to trust in God. And God is interested in producing faith in people, I believe. And faith is what he's after. Not, in fact, even goodness. Like, I think he's after it. Faith is, I mean, that might not be the socially acceptable thing to say, but it looks like the Bible is like, faith is what creates, you know, and faith working its way out in love and all that stuff. But people, the more the human spirit is such that the more good we do, the more tempted we are to trust in ourselves. And that is a project that actually produces less good in the long run, because it thrusts a person into themselves and their own internal resources, and it actually turns them away from God, and it turns them away from the surprise of the outside world of the Holy Spirit working in and through other people. This is why the transformative communities we're talking about, but namely the church and Alcoholics Anonymous, have acts of service are mandated not to earn God's favor, but because it sort of like takes you out of yourself a little bit. And that is where we see all sorts of, the condition from which we need to be saved is that sort of incurvatus in se, you know, the curving in that, that doesn't allow us to not only love other people, but to even see them or acknowledge that they are as real as we are. And so that's where I think, and once you're also in the game of counting, you know, is this good? How good is it? What about this other good thing I did? You're in the accounting department of life, and which is a no-win situation. It's a balance sheet type of understanding of God, which I fundamentally think is at odds with the Christian gospel. I mean, I think that people hear some of that and they're like, well, are you saying, like, you know, it doesn't matter what you do? And I think it matters to your neighbors a great deal what you do. But when you're in the accounting department, the scorekeeping, you're sort of, it's its own logic that produces cruelty and justification and rationalization, that we're, I think the gospel frees us from the tyranny of deserving, you know?
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this question in terms of the good or not good that other people do. Like, I can certainly see, looking at myself, I can see ulterior motives. And I can, even if I don't see them, I can be aware that they're probably there. Are we bound theologically to impugn the motives of people we don't know that apparently, as far as we can tell, are doing things out of the goodness of their heart for no reward and that kind of thing?
Gosh, well, I mean, I think a low anthropology certainly removes us from the judgment seat. I mean, it says that, like, I don't really have my experience of other people, even the ones who appear to have it all together, is it? There are chinks in that armor, and it's sometimes they're much bigger than you ever realize. You know, that's the experience of being in ministry. Okay. And that I also am no longer beholden to sort of weigh their merits as a Christian. I think I can appreciate their good works. I think I can hope that they have great motives, but it's not up to me to figure it out, while also knowing that that I quote at the beginning, like, a low anthropologist sort of don't try not to compare your insides with other people's outsides, because that's what we do. I look at the good works my neighbors are doing, and my response is seldom, oh, hooray. My response is usually, why can't I be like that? What's wrong with me that I'm not like that? And a low anthropology basically says that everyone's an imposter in some respect, that those works may be genuinely wonderful, but don't be fooled into thinking that they're not a sinner just like you. Yeah. And that if you really knew, the only reason you think they're so great is that you don't know them very well. But also, if you're gonna if to know their weaknesses and their shameful things and their embarrassing things is the only way you're ever gonna love them. You may not love them, but you certainly won't love them if you never know the full picture of their lives.
So this essentially kind of eradicates passing judgment in the positive or in the negative.
I would say with God's grace, yes. I mean, it's not over the
person, over who they are, over the person.
Over the person. It's just not in your job description.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, but again, people hear that and they think, oh, are you saying that there's no such thing as good and bad people? I mean, I'm saying that there's no such thing as good and bad people. Right. I think there are good and bad, terrible things that people do. Mm-hmm. I think the complicated thing about life under the sun is that quote unquote good people are often capable of acts of extraordinary malice and short-sightedness and selfishness. And quote unquote bad people are capable of acts of incredible beauty and lasting love. You know, it's I wish it weren't the case, but
I love that quote, by the way. I'm going to use it. Bad people are capable of incredible beauty and lasting love.
Mm-hmm.
It may be what you said. I'm going to go back and listen to it anyways. I have this is not a gotcha podcast, but I do have kind of a question. I don't mean it to be tough, but it's kind of like in knowing the reality of the world type of question and how to deal with this next thing I want to bring up. You talk about like not wanting to get into the accounting department of life. But the fact of the matter is so much life is characterized by the use of metrics to measure. I mean, we get it into measuring productivity and which is needed for the sustainability of our economic life and everything. And from my angle, I'm especially where my mind's at right now is when it comes to accountability as far as like character building. What I mean by that, you mentioned in your book about how you spent some time on burnout and how burnout leads to despair. And I like how you really, you pinpoint that this burnout, the burnout that so many in our culture and our society are experiencing that is leading to this despair, this burnout is not coming as much as you would think. It's not necessarily coming from social media. It's not from that overstimulation, though there's unhealthy aspects of that. It may not even necessarily be from overworking and busyness, even though that overworking and busyness is definitely a prevalent thing.
Mm.
But that burnout is traced to expectations. Expectations, whether external or internalized. Mm. My question, I guess, is are expectations good? Because, you know, I've spent the last, all of my ministry up to this point, and listeners who listen to my podcast know that my ministry is they've heard the news. I'm entering a slightly new ministry now, well, a very different new ministry in a different setting. But my ministry up until this point has been in schools. I have taught high schoolers and middle schoolers, and as much as I've seen how kids growing up in this culture need grace, they really do. I want to fully say that. What I'm saying, they need grace, but they are all because they're in a merciless culture in so many ways, same ones that adults are in. But at the same time, when you're in the business of educating and bringing up to the business, when you're in the vocation of that, accountability is so important. A lot of it for moral character development. And when you don't have that accountability piece of, you know, it and again, maybe this gets into, you know, there is a long gospel distinction that each play a role. There's two kingdoms, right? Which we've done episode two. But you know, I've had to like lay down the law in a sense, and I've had to admonish, for the sake of people in their growth, young people in their growth, to know right from wrong and to know that there are expectations. As much as I fully get why expectation leads to burnout. Also, our where does that fit in though? Our expectation is good though. You know what I mean? Is that too much?
People think, are you saying there's no expectation is bad in every case? How do the lights stay on? Don't we need policemen? You know, and don't we need traffic lights and all this stuff? I'm not trying to argue for some sort of anarchy in any regard. I think But when it comes to adolescence, by the way, having done a lot of youth ministry, I think it's not grace if there's no sort of sense of what the adolescent brain does oftentimes, if you're not careful, it hears talk about God's grace, and it's the response is like, hey, you can't tell me what to do. I'm in my own God, you know, and that's not the contrite response of someone who's heard the grace of the God who's been forgiven. That is simply a childish kind of looking for an excuse to kind of to bless something they've already decided to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's evidence of a low anthropology in a certain way, you know, kind of they're not like teenagers are nothing if not lessons in doubleness. Like they, you know, you tell them what to do and they immediately want to do the opposite. So I think that, yeah, I think expectation, you have to be kind of careful with it, because I think in general, this book is written to those who don't struggle from a lack of expectation in their lives. They struggle with way too much and crushing expectation. So it's a slightly contextual answer to that question. Mm-hmm. Like if another way to put it is like sometimes expectations can communicate love, you know, like I think very oftentimes if you're a person who's been told that they're not capable of anything good and that there's do whatever you want is sort of a negligence, you know, or indifference to, and then to tell kids, actually, I expect you, I think you can do this and I expect you to. What they're hearing is a kind of a confidence and a blessing. In fact, they're not hearing a condemnation. And the role of a good coach, a good teacher, is to find out when the line is crossed into actual condemnation and when they need the word of grace. But for a young man, for example, on a football team, needs to be told, you're going to be out here every day and you're going to be doing push-ups, and I believe you can do it. It's going to be hard, but if we want to win this game, this is what's going to happen. And to a young man, sometimes that is an enormous vote of confidence, in fact. And that's not the same as the neurotic not enoughness that we receive by nature of a perfectionistic approach to life. But that same young man, when he's in his mid-20s and is told that if he shows any weakness, that life is one huge football game, and if he shows any weakness or evidence of his limitation, that he is the only one who is that, like that he shouldn't, and that he can't, and that there's no mercy for him if he does, then you get into a different type of situation. So I think that's partly the, what I'm trying to say is sometimes what sounds like the law can actually be the gospel, and what sounds like the gospel can actually be the law. And to leave someone to their own devices so thoroughly at a young age is actually not a gracious thing. And structure, all that stuff can be important. The wisdom and the burden of being a mentor type figure in any situation is knowing, is having sensitivity to figure out where,
right,
you know, the two keys are need to be turned. That's my short, long answer to that question.
It's a beautiful answer. Thank you.
I think that, so that kind of connects to a part of low anthropology that it was a balm for my soul to read, which was low anthropology and religion. Mm. And one of the things that you did was, not to give too much away, but you talked about the sort of quintessential experience of campus ministry in college, where someone goes in and they find the message of acceptance and the message of hope and the message that God loves them. They get inculcated and find that mainly what they get shortly thereafter is discipline. And so by that, I mean, you know, like the reformed marks of the church, word, sacrament, and church discipline, right? Mm. So it's the sociological model of believe, belong, behave, right?
Right.
And so it reminded me of several experiences that I had. I grew up as an evangelical Episcopalian. Most people on the podcast know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad's a priest. And so like we would do some things that were sort of American evangelical as a youth group that weren't always necessarily condoned by my dad, but the youth leader wanted to do them. And so we went to things like Acquire the Fire. And I think I gave my life to the Lord like 10 times, but I kept wanting to take it back. I remember in college, I went to a campus ministry that could be described as evangelical. And I just remember being there and feeling accepted. But then when we got there, much of the preaching was about how you need to do better and be better. I remember also, it's happened recently where a contemporary Christian music artist who was raised in a sort of non-denominational environment found the beauty of the liturgy and became Roman Catholic, and recently has left the faith because of all of the things, all of the expectations that she felt, and probably some of the Roman Catholic perspective on infused righteousness and things like that, that were utterly desolating. And so in all of that, what I'm saying is that is a message that very few people are willing to say, that everyone needs to hear, and ultimately that should be, even in the midst of feeling like my stomach drop as I was reading it, because I remembered all the stuff that happened, it was also a comfort, a moment of grace and mercy, because it showed that, like, hey, one, I'm not alone in this.
Yeah.
Two, like, this is not how God universally interacts with every single human being, that, like, you better be better or else I'm not going to love you. So I guess if there's a question in this, it would be, is there anything else that you'd want to add to that, that you felt like wasn't able to pile into that immensely helpful chapter?
Thanks, James. I mean, by the way, a lot of the, I wrote this book with, like, you know, just the general person on the street in mind. And I think that there can be a slight frustration that it's not quite Christian enough. So folks who are coming at it in the church or sort of with a lot of baggage I've been told that they should read that chapter first to kind of catch a little bit of where I'm going with things, which is called Low Anthropology and Religion. Yeah, I have a lot to say about this. I think that the fervor and energy of the kind of evangelical experience of religion is by and large, I think, a really good thing. And there's passion there. There's an understanding that this is for me, that God cares about me. The relationship language can get really co-opted into kind of like a dating God thing, or a sort of tit for tat relationship, kind of I call you, you call me, and it becomes anthropomorphized, majorly speaking. However, there's a reason why so many people who are in ministry were actually converted through those ministries, because they're effective in communicating the emotional gravity of the gospel. Where they always or almost always falter is they adopt a high anthropology once you become a Christian, and then the life of the Christian becomes a life of a new law, and a very arbitrary one, oftenly very, very one that's usually very focused around sex and alcohol, and that is what causes people to quote unquote deconstruct or just run away in large numbers. That's what high anthropology religion devastates people's lives, and it really is terrible, because the thing that drew you to Christianity, which is the grace and forgiveness of God, is somehow withheld from you once you become a Christian, or at least maybe not explicitly, but implicitly and culturally, it becomes a new pressure cooker.
Right.
And that is a very, very pernicious, and it's the reason why the Reformation, a lot of the Reformation can be traced to needing to root that sort of semi-Pelagian understanding out of the church, and for the sake of the gospel, and for the sake of, you know, because we're burying, you know, people at funerals, you know, no one's talking about any of that stuff. You're talking about the forgiveness of sins and the resurrection of the dead, and God's, you know, the righteousness, the imputed righteousness of the blood of Jesus. Like, those are the things that last. How well you were able to, you know, not get drunk when you were between the ages of, you know, 19 and 21, no one's thinking about. So, and that's not to say there's not drunk driving and people don't get hurt and scar each other up, you know, sexually and all sorts of things that youth ministers care about. But I find that the problem with the church is usually some form of a selectively high anthropology. Now that I, in my experience, the Roman Catholics do this, and Anglo Catholics do it through sort of an infused righteousness and a kind of a churchiness, which I personally don't find very compelling, but I know that it can be helpful because it's usually lower wattage than the kind of you're going straight to hell, because there's always a, you know, when we just talked about the altar call that you were saved, you know, 9 times, like, technically every service in a liturgical setting, every service is that same crisis of confession and absolution, you know, like, and that's why we're drawn to it, just because it's not an altar call one time, it's every single week,
right?
And so but I find just in practice there's more permission in a kind of a Catholic understanding of the world to be sort of lukewarm or to just be a total hypocrite, or that you can always go and confess, you know. Mm-hmm. Functionally speaking, I'm not theologically I'm very Protestant, but I find that the way that that is, the form that sometimes takes, is like you have to be completely on fire for Jesus and 100% committed and always getting better and more holy, mm-hmm, every second of the day, right, or else there's no room for you in this pack at all. So everyone's like, well, then I just can't keep it up, you know, so right, I'm out.
Right.
Ironically, Protestantism culturally, well, even in theologically, in some of the later strands, has taken, has erred on much, in much more high, has been higher anthropologists than a lot of Catholics functionally. So,
right.
Well, and going off of what you're saying here, and I have a similar background in terms of, like, I grew up like a charismatic Pentecostal. And so I've got a similar background to going to camp or going to these events and having this experience. And for me, it was like I would go and my excitement and my energy was up, and I never wanted sin less, and I never wanted God more. And I left and I felt like I had this little candle in my hand that I had to protect. And I was so worried that it was going to get blown out, that I was going to fall down on my guard and I was going to lose it and have to come get it back again. And there's something comforting about that just being, hey, guess what? You're going to lose it. And you get to come back here next Sunday, you know?
Yeah. Rather than people assume, well, then the candle doesn't exist or it's terrible or something like that. No, the candle's real. Like that stuff is real. It's just like the human sort of construct that's put on top of that as like, okay, now little Timmy, you know, you're 11 years old, you better let that light shine or else. That's what's heard. Mm-hmm. And I used to think it's a straw man, you know, I won't be too hard on this sort of capital E evangelicalism, but it's not, unfortunately. It's very functionally the way that people were brought up. But I sympathize. I mean, I've heard that story so many times that it just breaks my heart. And but when I think that the heart of the Christian faith is where you, the church or God is who you turn to when you failed, you know, or when you can't keep it up, rather than the last place you go with your shame.
Yeah. Dave, I know our time's the time we gave you is coming to a close. And it may last a couple more. I do want to do that fun round of questions.
Let's do it, man. There's another question. I'll take one more question.
Let's do one more question. And on a note that's not shame, because I know it's kind of a note. The last note we ended on. It was a good note, though. I don't have another question, Judge.
Well, I'll just say this. The hope of the book is what you said when you said, I'm not the only one like this. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to get across to people. I wrote a book, and whether I succeeded or not, it's a different question. But I wrote a book because I wanted to take like 3 steps back from where some kind of Christian books start. And I wanted to say, like, why is faith in God compelling? Why would it be compelling or urgent in the first place? And that's what I'm trying to lay out. So my hope is that people feel recognized by the book, and in that recognition, in a compassionate form which takes into account all the pain and of life, that they would then be pointed towards, like, well, see, as a Christian, this is where I turn to Jesus. Like, I don't have any fancy, you know, 3-point plan for you. Like, I think that the intervention of God upon the human race is where This is why I believe it's such good news and why I believe it's such urgent news. So I want to communicate, first of all, you're not alone in terms of you're not the only one who's like this. And that's the reaction I've received from a lot of people. And I say that I've received that from, you know, women in their 70s, as well as kids in their teens. That's what I want. I wanted that recognition of like, yes, this is actually what life is like. It goes further than sort of the enshrinement of vulnerability, qua vulnerability, because it sort of says the confession that we're dying to unload of what it's like to be me is met not with further condemnation, but with forgiveness. And that's where true hope lies. And so that's what I want to leave people with. I don't want to leave them with a sense that of their own inadequacies. I want to leave them with the hope that they're not isolated, and that in fact they are both known and loved. So it's the book is hoping to convey some kind of grace to you and I, and to make the case for why Christianity would be of any kind of appeal in a world that says, that has painted it as yet another ladder to climb or another vehicle of shame, when I feel it's the place to go with your shame.
Right. Dave, thank you. This has been a fabulous episode.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. I know I've preached a little bit. I've had a long day, so I was maybe a little more sober.
You're not afraid to, you're not afraid to talk about these things. And that's why I admire you and your book. And that's why I think so many people are being drawn to your message, because you're not ashamed of the gospel. And you're really bringing it to us in ways that ordinary people, that sounds condescending, but in ways that everyday people, you know, in a rather Christian or secular culture, where it's really grace is being conveyed to them, and they can hear it. So thank you.
Thank you, Drew. Thanks, James. Yeah.
In our fun round, so I've seen you like pictures. You post a lot of pictures on Instagram, speaking of social media and our fictional image. But I think this is authentically you, because I've seen like a bunch of pictures on Instagram of you and your book tour, and I've seen you in like three different KISS shirts. So my question is, who is your favorite member of the band KISS?
Ace Frehley, no question.
Oh my gosh, that's literally my favorite one too.
And in fact, Drew.
Yeah.
About to blow your mind.
An Ace Frehley action figure. I'm sorry, our listeners, we don't do video of this. We could. I mean,
it's hanging right behind me.
Ace Frehley action figured. Dave just showed me. I will admit that KISS is an. I used to be embarrassed. I think KISS is an objectively not a good band. So sorry to, but I think the idea of them is fun.
And, they're terrible, and that's what's so great. That's one of the reasons it's so great about them. I host a podcast called the Well of Sound, which is a music podcast that has nothing to do with religion, or at least outside of what everything has to do with religion. But our podcast on KISS is the funniest thing. It's like, if a teenage boy can be ministered to by those buffoons, like, then maybe he can too. I think.
Well,
yeah.
But I will say objectively, Ace Frehley is a pretty good guitar player. I mean, he's good.
He has his moments. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, he has his moments.
He has his moments.
All right.
Good. I don't know if good can be applied to anything in the KISS world, except
any thoughts on KISS from James or Stephen before we move on to the next fun round question. And KISS does not stand for Kids in Satan's Service.
No.
Those big E evangelicals made that up in like the 1980s. That's not true. It actually means keep it simple and stupid, because that's what their music is. next fun round question. If you could go back in time and have a conversation with Luther or Calvin, which one and why?
I mean, Luther, no question. Like, I would, I think he'd, I think Calvin would probably talk longer, but I think Luther would say more objectionable and like offensive things. He might even insult me to my face. So like I think it'd be he'd be less polite, but it would be it would be worth the trip, shall we say?
Right, right. Love it.
What about James and Stephen? Curious, like you're Luther or Calvin, if you had to go back. I think I know both your answers.
For me, it'd be Luther, just because I've been asking so many questions recently. It'd be nice to just go straight to the source and stop bothering everybody else.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Luther too. I think it'd be a fascinating conversation with Calvin, but I think it would end up coming to blows because Calvin and I disagree about some things. But yeah, definitely Luther. I would be incredibly lucky and blessed if Luther would insult me. The Luther insulter online is
yes,
that's comedic gold.
Yeah. One of the great inventions of the internet.
Right.
If people aren't aware of that.
But no, Luther, in all seriousness, Luther, because Luther is so foundational to my understanding of the gospel. But it's because Luther understands Paul correctly. And anyways,
we got you.
Yeah.
The next question I have to, well, it's kind of two, because I have to find out first, do you collect those pop Funko vinyl, the people with the big heads?
I have a bunch of them. Let's put it that way.
Only because I know you're so, I'm looking, I know our listeners can't see your video, but I'm seeing like comic books and Star Wars stuff all over the
Now
background.
You can see here. You want to see my.
Well, I was about to ask you. Is that Axl Rose?
That's Axl Rose, the Funko Pop. I've also have got Morrissey behind me. So
Morrissey. I was about to ask you what is the most interesting one you have? Morrissey, I didn't know they had Morrissey.
There's a Morrissey is probably, well, Axl Rose never licenses his appearance, his image to anyone. So it's like a miracle that this
rare
exists. You know, you can find, I've got a Slash action figure behind me that, you know, slashes on everything. You'll never see Axl anywhere, but here he is with his bandana. So that's probably my favorite. But the Morrissey one is of him in Smith's era. And I happen to prefer solo Morrissey, but he's got the gladiola flowers hanging out of his back pocket, which he used to have on like performances when he was young and, you know, pretentious. So it was.
So James and Steven, do you have any, or are we the only nerds here?
I've got a hefty collection of comics, but no Funko Pops. My wife wouldn't let me collect them.
I had a couple that I won, or my wife and I both won some at like a trivia night. They were giving them away.
Oh, nice. Which one's the most interesting that you got?
I don't know who they are, and I gave them to my sister and brother-in-law who collect them. So.
Okay.
Like, here are these plastic dolls, if you guys seem to like them.
I only have four.
What do you got?
My most interesting one is Miles Davis.
Wow. Okay.
And that's what I intentionally bought online. The other three I came across over the time. But I wanted the Miles Davis one. So.
Interesting. Well, all right.
Yeah, I don't know if it's official. It might be a bootleg one, but it says Miles Davis. It's a good one. And let me go get him. I mean, the listeners won't see, so I'll just edit this part out. But
I was going to tell Dave that the very nice.
That's late period Miles too. That's like on the corner Miles.
Yeah,
Axl Rose one. When you showed it to us, it looked. I honestly thought it was Willie Nelson. Let's be honest.
It did kind of look like Bill. It did kind of look like Willie Nelson.
It's Axl in his kilt wearing phase. You know, he used to sometimes wear a catcher's like protector and a kilt and a huge bandana. It was an amazing look. So
yeah.
Next fun round question is the best. You know, this has to do with your work with Christ Episcopal. You're the best adult ed class you ever taught, like, or one you enjoyed the most and like felt the most fed by.
I taught a class on the Holy Spirit on the during the pandemic. Specifically my younger brother, who's a theology professor in England, he wrote a book called The Holy Spirit and Christian Experience, and I taught a whole class on it. And it was, you know, Episcopalians never talk about the Holy Spirit. I hadn't really, you know, I'd avoided certain elements of it. We always associate it with various things, but it was really. I taught about the history of Pentecostalism and Azusa Street and all that stuff. And I found it to be remarkably fructifying, shall we say. But I've taught plenty of other courses. I taught one up on the Apostles' Creed that I was very happy with too.
Yeah, actually, I wrote a paper on Azusa Street in college, and one of the things I thought was interesting about it, like, because that happened in really close proximity to the earthquake, the San Francisco earthquake. Talk about like getting people to church. We had a move of God right after the world comes to an end. But that's a fascinating, fascinating story, fascinating time.
That's and Stephen used that when we did an episode, one of our first episodes.
Yeah.
He used his paper from college.
Cool.
It was good. And the last question is, your favorite podcast or podcast you've been listening to the most of, other than Doth Protest Too Much, of course.
Of course.
And other than anything that, you know, because I know Mockingbird is podcast, we can't count those, but one that you're really into.
Sure. The one that I've gotten a huge kick out of just the last couple of weeks is this podcast called Dead Eyes. Have you heard about it? It's with this guy who's named Connor Radcliffe, who is a extra, or had a very small role in Band of Brothers that, you know, Spielberg and Tom Hanks did. And he was fired by Tom Hanks directly for having, quote unquote, dead eyes. And this is him like 20 years later, like trying to figure out what on earth that meant, talking to other people who were fired for reasons they don't understand. And this season, I haven't gotten there yet, but Tom Hanks actually comes on the podcast. But it's one of these things that could only exist in our time. And there's a lot of humor about, and a lot of talk about just rejection and the human condition. But Dead Eyes, I recommend it.
Nice. Dead Eyes. And what's the music one you do? I'm going to look that up.
The Well of Sound. We just put out that's my favorite podcast, to be honest with you, because the guy who does it with me, they're like audio documentaries. We just put out a 3-hour episode about Meat Loaf and Jim Stein nice. And Jim Steinman. So it's like we did a 2-part, you know, 6 hours about Genesis and Phil Collins, and these aren't necessarily my favorite artists, but we have a lot of fun delving into all sorts of corners of. It's highly produced, so it takes a long time to do, but I love that podcast.
Nice. Well, for our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Dave, thank you for being here. This has been a very fun episode, a very good episode, and God bless everyone.
Thank you, guys.